Hello, I'm Mark Denis, and this is number 0288, The Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. C'est très, très bon. It's full of stuff. Great stuff. Mais oui, send it your way right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of The Stuff File Program, number 0288. And coming up on this edition of The Stuff File Program, we have another visit from writer Stephen Paul Leyva, who's a great friend of the show. He talks about his new novel, By the Sea, a book that takes place at a hotel near an undisclosed beach.
It's sort of a fantasy land in the sense that you don't really know where this beach is. It's somewhere in the United States, but is it East Coast, is it West Coast? That's all left up to your imagination. It's also a beach that you reach after a long drive, and it's often fog-covered. And like I say, it's a scruffy beach. It's not a beach that tourists come to or vacationers come to.
We have a 20-year-old retro interview with the late fashion maven, Mr. Blackwell, back when he wrote his book, From Rags to Bitches.
I remember sitting in an alley under a fire escape, crying my eyes out, saying, isn't there anyone who would love me? I remember having to pay a price when I was in the dress business for an order by having to have a relationship with buyers that would absolutely nauseate me. I remember having wonderful romances in Hollywood with people that would probably say, oh, really? But these people held out their hand, and they said, we love you. Even for a moment, we love you.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. And on this edition of Book Banter, we look at Trudeau, the next generation, with Justin Trudeau's memoir, Common Ground. So will it be from 24 Sussex Drive and back again? Find out later on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0288 is legendary Montreal broadcaster Mark Denis. You can check out Mark's many nostalgic websites, such as Mark Denis' CKGM, Montreal's Super 70s tribute page, and Mark Denis' CFOX Montreal radio archive. And also check out his regular website, which is markdenis.com. All the links are available on the What's On page, which Mark just told you which show it was, 0288. And Mark was also somebody that I kind of idolized when he was at CKGM back in the day and I was a teenager dying to be in radio. And I was lucky enough to work with him for a brief period of time at FM 96 in Montreal. A really, really nice guy. And I thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Emergency responders are bracing themselves for an upswing in emergency calls related to sex play gone wrong now that the movie 50 Shades of Grey has been released. Such an upswing would correspond to a previous surge that occurred when the books became popular. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission reports 83% of the cases involved, as they delicately put it, foreign body removals, in men more than women, by the way, and 25% involve injuries severe enough to require specialized care and/or hospital admission, not just ER visits. Indeed, firefighters and medics in London, England, say they've seen many cases of people trapped in handcuffs since the books came out. We hope filmgoers will use common sense and avoid leaving themselves red-faced, said London Fire Brigade 3rd Officer Dave Brown. London fire crews are now dispatched to about 40 sex-related calls per month, and not just for handcuffs and vacuum cleaners. They also have stories involving toasters. By the way, I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey, nor am I going to, just for the record. So I had to Google to find out about the toasters. Now, thankfully, it turns out, that has nothing to do with the book, but in Britain, a man did get his penis stuck in a toaster. I shudder to think if it was plugged in or not, and if it was, what setting was used. Yeah. One more Stuff File news story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A drug-sniffing dog at the Hamilton County, Ohio Justice Center, which includes the county jail, alerted that there was something wrong with a package addressed to an inmate. Inside the package, a Bible. Jailers expected to find drugs jammed between two pages, but didn't find any. They did find a half-dollar-sized coffee-looking stain on the first page of the Book of Daniel, however, and sent that to the lab for testing. The lab found it was 30 to 40 hits of heroin. The inmate, 28-year-old Timothy King, and the alleged sender, 39-year-old Tahani Tepe, were arrested on felony charges and face up to 5 years in prison. Deputies noted that in the particular edition of the Bible used for the crime, the Book of Daniel starts on page 420. The Lord works in mysterious ways. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Writer Stephen Paul Leyva is a good friend of this show. He has a new book out called By the Sea. As it says on the back cover, By the Sea is a modern comic adult fairy tale with an ensemble cast of Cinderellas. But what does that actually mean? Well, Steve is on the line with us right now from California to talk about it. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you, because it's always a pleasure.
I have to first of all ask to you, what does it mean to have an ensemble of Cinderellas? What is a Cinderella to you? Because I know that's different things to different people.
Well, Cinderella is a person who isn't in a situation that makes them happy, correct? I mean, if you're getting the cinders out of the fireplace and that's all you do and you have to sew up your stepsister's dresses and they browbeat you, and, you know, the only people you have to talk to are mice, you're not going to be very happy. So Cinderella is a person who's not engaged in something that fulfills them, shall we say. So in this book, we have both male and female Cinderellas that are at that juncture in their life.
Now, you know, a cynic, somebody who is very pessimistic, would say you've basically...
You mean like you, Peter?
Not me. I'm very optimistic. Oh, okay. I'm a very optimistic person. But a cynic might look at this and go, well, it sounds like you're describing basically the modern middle class.
Yeah, I don't think that... that's any problem we have to worry about. I'm dealing with individuals.
Okay.
You'll see in the description also that, and people should understand that this is a contemporary story. That's why I say modern adult fairy tale. It's not actually proposed as a fairy tale with actual fairies and dragons and things like that. But I do put it in sort of its own little kingdom that I created, which is a residential hotel on this rather scruffy beach called Leech Beach. And I deal with the number of the residences in the hotel and workers at the hotel and how their lives interact and intersect. And each one either is a bit of a Cinderella, and some of them are a bit of a fairy godmother or a fairy godfather, depending, of course, on their gender.
Now, you've written various types of genres, so what brought this topic to you, and what was the impetus for this story?
It started with an image. It actually started with, there's a famous play called Separate Tables by Terence Rattigan, and they had made a lovely English movie about it many, many years ago. David Niven, I believe, starred, possibly Deborah Carr.
That's it, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and my mother, who is a great fan of English movies, would watch them a lot on television, and I would often be in the living room watching them with her. And I hadn't seen the movie for years. In fact, I just recently re-saw it for the first time since probably childhood, and certainly long after I wrote this book. But I always had this image of this residential hotel that was also in a coastal city. But the real image is of the dining room and the separate people that actually live in this hotel eating at their separate tables. Bang, you've got a microcosm right there. Or you have a nice little laboratory to put people in different kind of people. Why are they living in a residential hotel instead of, as you say, middle-class America out in the suburbs? Well, that's not the kind of people these are. They're there for one reason or another, either working there or living there. And it's sort of a fantasy land in the sense that you don't really know where this beach is. It's somewhere in the United States, but is it East Coast, is it West Coast? That's all left up to your imagination. It's also a beach that you reach after a long drive, and it's often fog-covered. And like I say, it's a scruffy beach. It's not a beach that tourists come to or vacationers come to. And by creating that, I create a place where I can take these characters, move them around, examine what their desires in life are, and then making it into a fairy tale, I provide them with their fairy godmothers or godfathers, and things change, and the book has happy endings.
But yet it's not, as you described it here, it's not Fantasy Island.
No, it's not that. no one's getting their riches. It goes on the assumption that happiness possibly comes from a fulfillment of being able to truly and genuinely express yourself, of what kind of person you are, what you really need to express. So the book deals a lot with art and the making of art, both visual art, dramatic art, or a love of artifacts like antiques, or a passion for things from the past. Or one of the characters has a passion for, and he used to work in Hollywood, but he has a passion for older movies of the 30s and 40s. And so it deals with that. It's a comic novel, a bit gentle, I suppose, in the telling. But that was the mission I laid out for myself. Or actually, that's the mission that came as I started to write. Because like I say, it started with that image, different people living in a residential hotel, sitting at their separate tables in the dining room. Okay, now where do we go from there?
And when you start to write, in your own process, when you start to write something like this, and I think you kind of just already maybe answered that question, do you know where the story is going as you start to write? Do you know where it's going to end up? Or is that something you learn along the way as a writer?
It's a combination of both. I really sort of started from that, like I say, that one image. As I started to create characters, as you know, I spent many years involved with and associated with the great animator Chuck Jones. And Chuck always said the character is everything. Once you know who your characters are, that will dictate the plot. And so I fairly well created my characters first and defined them as I was started the writing. The first chapter, in a sense, introduces all the various players, most of them, some come in later, that are going to be involved, and their relationships. And then I started realizing, well, this person's going to intersect with this person, and going to ask something of this person, and this person's reaction is going to be such, and et cetera, et cetera. So it barrels along and starts to tell itself, although out of it, of course, being generated from my own rather silly subconscious, I suppose.
Well, you mentioned a sort of philosophy behind the characters and who they are and why they live there. Is this a philosophy that is an extension of your own?
On happiness?
Yes.
Absolutely. I wrote it at a time period, too, where for one reason or another that we don't necessarily need to go into, I wasn't being allowed to be as fulfilled in expressing myself and my talent in what I was doing, and being able to take time off of the day to work on this novel allowed me to do that. And so it became the theme because it generated directly from my life at that moment. Because when you write a book, it's always going to be the moment is going to tell. If you write this kind of a book, especially, but even if you're writing a genre work, and as you know, I've written in thrillers, and I've written a science fiction book, although all of them, I think you admit, are satiric or comic in nature. When you're writing that kind of a book, you're more plot-driven. Although this book certainly has a plot, this was more character-driven, and as the philosophy of came into it, then everything you start to write starts to service that. It talks to you as you're doing it.
Well, since, as you mentioned, this book came out of a certain time period within your life, if you were to compare it, if not necessarily you, but if other people who know you well would compare it to the other works that you've done, even though you've been, as you say, in various genres, would they be able to tell things about you and your life at the time period in which you wrote that book?
By reading By the Sea?
By the Sea or any of your or previous books?
Well, yeah, actually, possibly even more for some of the previous books. For By the Sea, they might, but it's fairly well costumed, so to speak. My two fixer novels, as you know, take place in Hollywood, and I spent a good 20 years or so working in Hollywood. So another thing Chuck Jones always said, not Chuck Jones, but my other great friend, Ray Bradbury, always said what he loved about writing is he's able to kill off his enemies, his past enemies. I certainly was able to do that in the fixer novels, because Hollywood is a difficult road to travel down sometimes.
Who are you hoping to reach as far as your audience is concerned with By the Sea?
You know, I don't want to peg it and call it a woman's novel, but I have a feeling female readership would appreciate the book the most. There's romance involved. There's also sex involved. But any reader that, male or female, that's looking to have, and I almost hate to call it this, but I suppose it is, because I'm getting this reaction, as a comfortable read. It's a read about people that I think you're going to like. I think you're going to like being among them. There's a few bad apples in the story, and they get their particular comeuppance as well. But hopefully it's a story that you will relate to it. I've already had one reviewer on Goodreads who immediately picked out and said, I'm like this character, Allison, and if my life had gone a certain way, that's exactly how my life would have been. So I think it's relatable, and there's a number of men characters as well, and they would be relatable. But, you know, if we be honest, in publishing today, the mass majority of readers are female. They're buying the most books. They're reading the most books. Guys are watching football, I guess. I don't know.
Mm. Well, the book is called By the Sea, and the subtitle, A Comic Novel. It's written by Stephen Paul Ava, and of course you can find it in all the usual locations, including Amazon.com. Steve, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Peter, and I hope everybody gathers by the sea.
Author Stephen Paul Ava. His book is called By the Sea. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0288, and you'll find the links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll play for you a retro interview from 20 years ago from Mr. Blackwell, back when he wrote his book From Rags to Bitches. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But, of course, we have more Stuff File news for you right here, right now. Oklahoma State Senator Nathan Dom, a Republican, has introduced a bill to undo a law sponsored in 2007 by Representative Joe Dorman, who was a Democrat. What's the partisan squabble about this time? Dorman's bill, which was passed, designates the watermelon as Oklahoma's state vegetable. Dom's attempt to repeal the law isn't falling on party lines, however. We will defend, support, and make sure it is upheld as the state vegetable of Oklahoma, countered Republican Representative Scooter Park, who now holds Dorman's House seat. But Dom is pressing on. Because watermelons, he says, are not vegetables, but rather fruits. And the watermelon can't be the state fruit because strawberries already are. Well, that's a step in the right direction. Most politicians only deal with sour grapes, but I digress. Let's take a closer look at this, shall we? Watermelons are indeed fruits. So how did all of these numbskulls pass this bill back in 2007 in the first place, deeming it the state vegetable? On the other side of the coin, Oklahoma must have, what, zero crime rate, clean streets, a burgeoning economy, and disgustingly happy, well-adjusted citizens. I mean, what other reason could the politicians have to make this such a weighty issue? I think they need a new state motto. Oklahoma, a utopia where watermelons are vegetables. Yeah. Moving right along, the owner, speaking of food, by the way, the owner of the Kingsland Vegetarian Restaurant in the suburb of Canberra, Australia, apologized in February for the cockroach infestation that contributed to a $16,000 fine, explaining that, for moral reasons, he could not bring himself to exterminate living things, even cockroaches. Less well defended were Kingsland's toilets, grease, and food storage shortcomings. Yeah, okay. Why don't we just kill the idea of this particular vegetarian restaurant altogether? You can't kill something, move on. And by the way, aren't you yanking vegetables out of the ground? Isn't that killing them? I don't know. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next segment, our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Swedish public broadcaster SVT, capitalizing on the country's supposedly liberal sexuality to promote an upcoming children's series on the human body, produced a one-minute cartoon featuring genitals, singing, and dancing. Okay, let that sink in for a moment. Yeah. However, the SVT program director admitted in January that there was criticism. Not for salaciousness, but because the penis was portrayed with a mustache and the vagina with long eyelashes, which some critics said, unfortunately, reinforced gender stereotypes. Really? So if you're not already associating a penis with a male and a vagina with a female, then your mind truly is an extremely blank canvas, isn't it? Wow. Gender stereotypes, huh? Alrighty then. Let's just press on, shall we? Wow. The Academy Awards have just passed, and each year people not only dish about the winners and their acceptance speeches, they also talk about the clothes they wear. Well, when it comes to the folks who are best known for dishing out about the fabrics of the Hollywood elite, all have to pay homage to the man who practically made it a blood sport. I'm talking about the famed Mr. Blackwell, who was well known for his worst dressed list. Mr. Blackwell died in 2008, but it was 20 years ago, back in June 1995, that he was one of the first celebrity interviews I did on my old radio show. So I thought at this post-Oscar moment, I would reminisce with one of the most fun interviews we've shared. At the time, Mr. Blackwell was promoting his book entitled From Rags to Bitches. Here's part of that interview now.
A lot of people are familiar with the list that you put out, but there's a lot about your life that I'm sure a lot of people are not familiar with, and it's to a certain degree, there's quite a bit of a hard luck story there, isn't there?
Well, there's a story there of a man that was not born with a great silver spoon in his mouth and a crystal chandelier over his head, and someone who did not drive a Rolls Royce to the nearest, let's say, bistro gardens. There's a story of survival. There's a story of a man born in Brooklyn who did not have even a home to sleep in. There's a story about a man who never knew his father. There's a story about a man who had 3 years of grade school education. And that goes on to Broadway, and that goes on to Hollywood, and all of a sudden the whole world seems to open up, and there is something wonderful and fantastic to talk about. But there's a message here that I think really, really is important. It's a little thing called survival. It's a little thing called have a little faith. It's a little thing about saying, okay, it happened. It wasn't bad. It was only an experience. There's something here about a man who says, I needed love, and took it any place it came. It's a man who did a lot of things that other people might have been ashamed of or embarrassed about, but it did not embarrass me. It's a story about a man who lived every alternative lifestyle you can imagine. And now you would probably say, why did you write the book? Why do you reveal yourself when you already have a rather opulent reputation?
Well, why would you do that?
I'm glad you asked. I'm glad you asked. Because it must be, and I remember when I was a much younger man, I remember looking for someone who would listen to me. I remember wanting someone to listen to me. I remember sitting in an alley under a fire escape, crying my eyes out, saying, isn't there anyone who would love me? I remember wanting someone just to hold my hands and say, I'm so glad you're here. I remember having to pay a price when I was in the dress business for an order by having to have a relationship with buyers that would absolutely nauseate me. I remember having wonderful romances in Hollywood with people that would probably say, oh, really? But these people held out their hand and they said, we love you. Even for a moment, we love you.
Okay. Well, you brought up on several occasions the idea of love, and I'm just wondering if a lot of your success and the things you've done in life has been driven by your desire just to be loved.
I think a lot of my success has been driven by the desire to be accepted. If you've ever been alone and never knew your father and never knew where a meal was coming from, all you really wanted was someone to need you for something. And then love became something that was probably the most emotional need you had. And you were absolutely willing to accept it under any condition, any term. And I don't want people who feel the same way that I did to be ashamed or embarrassed. I don't want those people to say, is there something wrong with me? No, there's nothing wrong with any human being that has any desire, different as it may be. There is nothing wrong with any human being who says, all right, I live this way, but I will do it well. I will do it with class, and I will do it with dignity. But, you know, we had terrific times. I worked with Mae West. I have wonderful stories about Mae. I worked with Howard Hughes. I have the most incredible story about Howard Hughes and being under contract to him. You know, I was with the little tough guys. which was another group of the Dead End Kids, which really changed my whole life. It was from that point I came to Hollywood. And coming to Hollywood was the big difference in my having survived. I honestly believe that if Sidney Kingsley Scouts, he was the author of Dead End in 1937, I honestly believe, Peter, and I mean this with all my heart, that if I had not been discovered, I would have been gone. I don't think you survive in that environment. If you make another day, you're lucky. You know how we used to live under a fire escape, Peter? I mean, I'm not asking the question because you couldn't possibly in your wildest dreams imagine this. We would break a milk bottle and hold the neck by the hand. And if anyone came towards us in our sleep, we would reach out and jab. And if we didn't jab, we would probably be killed.
Well, how does somebody in that situation get discovered in the first place? Well, a lot of people don't.
I was very lucky. The show Dead End was a show about boys from the Bowery, boys from very underprivileged neighborhoods. I was extremely lucky they had that show going on Broadway at that time, because any other show would never in a million years have even accepted me. I mean, there was nothing to accept. There was a kid, a slum kid. But when they took a look at me, they said, he looks the part. People will look at him and understand his emotions. That was the main thing. So I went into a road company of Dead End itself. I played Tommy, the leader. I forgot 90% of my lines. But as Sidney Kingsley said, we're not interested in the exact words. What we're trying to show people is there is a society that lives in this manner. But from there, I went to Hollywood. Thank heavens, things did turn around a little bit. Mother got little odd jobs. It was after the crash, and we were able to survive it. We got to Hollywood, and the Andrews sisters, Mother, was the first one to get me my first job at Universal Studio. Then I have the most wonderful story, Peter, about falling madly infatuated with a girl called Frances Gum. Do you know who that would be?
Judy Garland.
How do you like that? You do know. And then madly in love with this girl. There was absolutely nobody like her. I watched her destroy her own self by the studio. I watched her go from one level to another. I have a lot of this in the book. Mm-hmm. I thought Deanna Durbin, one of my better friends, who then saved Universal Studio from bankruptcy, would you believe it, who today lives in Paris and married to an extraordinarily wealthy man. And then I went on and on, and the biggest and most exciting experience I had as a young man probably was going back to Broadway and being on Broadway itself in a show called Catherine Was Great with Mae West. And that was the major, major growing up turning point. There are so many stories in here that you really can't just keep going on about them.
You've gone from literally the streets of Brooklyn, New York, into the world of Broadway and Hollywood, and that is a major monumental leap on its own.
But you got to remember, we got there through an alley.
Exactly.
We did not get there eating at Club 21.
And then on top of that, you know, the acting career goes okay to a certain degree, but you decide, for one reason or another, that maybe this is not what you should be doing, and you go into the world of fashion, which is an entirely different direction, and become successful there. I mean, that in itself is another leap that's sometimes hard to believe.
Well, do you know, sometimes people don't let doors open for them. Sometimes people turn things away. People say, well, I could have done it if, or I could have done it but. And that's not the case. There's a lot of things, by the way, that happened in between that. Going in the dress business was a result of doing costumes for a girl that I was managing. And that girl was a nightclub singer. Well, the reviews of her clothing was far better than that of her voice. So when the girl totally bombed out, I took those reviews downtown to a manufacturer and looked around for somebody who would give me a job. I had no idea. I mean, I wasn't bright or brilliant. I was just following very ordinary, common, I suppose, street gut feelings.
So where does your sense of fashion, or where did your sense of fashion first come from?
Where does a boy at 5 years old learn to play Chopin? How does that happen? I think maybe God gives us a wonderful gift and the ability to do these things. And we don't question them. And the most important thing is that we simply go ahead and we do them. The first year I was a designer, I became almost the rage of the fashion industry because I dared defy everybody else who was doing clothes that I thought were not as pretty and did what I believed was beautiful.
That must have annoyed your contemporaries at the time.
Well, they practically blacklisted me. As a matter of fact, the very first ad we ever did, and we did the ad figuring this, now I can admit it now, the ads at that time, believe it or not, were $3,000 a page. We were very new in business. So we decided to do an ad in both Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazine. All right, we were in the dress business. The accountant had told us we were bankrupted unless something major happened, that we just simply didn't have the accounts and we didn't have the money. So we decided on taking the ad, figuring, well, what if I can't pay for it? I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to take a cutting table? They can come and take the cutting table. It wouldn't have made any difference. But I did something so unusual that I became almost the conversation of 7th Avenue.
Was that when you used the ad and just had your own face?
The big portrait of me.
Big portrait of you.
Yeah, which was a very heavy-looking portrait. I mean, very tough-looking, very, very vendetta. I forgot to tell you that Howard Hughes had been the one to change my name from my acting name, which was Dick Ellis, to Richard Blackwell. Following Howard Hughes is when I became a dress designer, and that's who gave me my name. And that whole story is in the book itself, too.
Not only have you become a dress designer, however, you're basically the fashion police with your worst dress list. How did that come about?
Well, in 1960, having been known in Hollywood as, you know, a not altogether dynamite performer, and then they knew I had gone in the dress business, they said to me, would you do a list of the 10 best and the 10 worst dressed people in Hollywood? Now, this was never intended to be an annual.
Now, who was they?
The American Weekly. It was
American Weekly.
A Sunday supplement in newspapers all over the United States. Well, I did the article, outraged half of the people in the world. The other half of it loved it. And that began the image of the man who does the 10 worst dressed women. Now, the first year after it, nobody would touch it. The second year, people began to get curious. By the third year, more than five people showed up at a press conference. We tried it every year the same time, but it took 3 full years for it really to take hold. And by the time it took hold, it just exploded wide open. Now nobody thought of me as a dress designer. Nobody thought of me as a kid who had ever been an actor. Most of them didn't even know it. They thought of a man who does the list. And that's what I was basically known for. Just the guy who did the list. They thought I crawled out from under a rock once a year, made a few very acerbic statements, and crawled back under a rock. In the meantime, I had to go back and do a collection four times a year. And I love the lines in the, and I think that's what made it. It was not that I criticized their clothing by telling you I didn't like it because it was green or blue and it had a bow and it had a deep neck or it didn't. I did impression lines. I did lines that, in a way, told you what I thought about their clothing without ever mentioning the clothes. Do you remember in 1992 Gina Davis when she wore that dress with the mesh hosiery and that big tail behind it at the Academy Awards?
Yes.
Remember that dress?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I put her on the list. She was number two. But I never mentioned the color of the dress. All I did is I said, Big Bird in Heels, a Follies Berger fiasco. And that answered it best.
You can envision it without ever having seen it.
That's right.
One of the things that's very controversial about the book is it talks about some of the people you've had relationships with. And,
yes.
And this would come as a surprise to quite a few people. I'm wondering if you've heard from any of the families, friends, and relatives of those you've had relationships with and you talk about in the book, and if they have anything negative or positive to say about it.
No, and do you know something? I don't believe I'm going to. They began to lead completely different lives. You know, we're talking about a good many years ago.
Uh-huh.
I was 20 years old, and they were new in the studios. They were not married. It isn't as if they were married and lived a second kind of a life. These people were never married at that point, and then the studios demanded they get married in order to save their career.
We should mention for those who are listening who have no idea what we're talking about that you've had some relationships with some prominent male actors.
All right, and we can even tell you who they were. It was Tyrone Power, it was Randy Scott, and I will tell you here and now, I'm neither ashamed or embarrassed about it. You see, I had no father. I had nobody who ever gave a darn whether I was, you know, standing, sitting, dead or alive. And when these people offered me any sense of love, any sense of affection, I grabbed it. I was delighted that somebody cared I was alive. I didn't look at it as anything I had to be ashamed of. And one of the things this book is going to do, it's going to tell a lot of kids, you can live any life you choose, just do it well. It's going to tell a lot of people, it's okay. No one's going to set the rules for you anymore. The rules is, do it well, have respect for who you're with, and love.
This story is just that, quite a story. It's a life that has so many twists and turns in it that it could make an interesting movie. If you were making this movie, who would you cast as Mr. Blackwell?
At the very end? I had never thought about the beginning. At the very end of the book, maybe the last 25 years, I would choose John Malkovich.
Why is that?
Well, I think he's an incredible actor. I think he has many faces. I think he can look any way you would choose him to do. And I think he has the ultimate in class.
Well, it certainly is quite the story, as I mentioned. And you've managed to fit quite a life into one book. I thank you for talking with us this evening and continued success with all you do, sir.
Peter, tell everybody they can have anything in the world they want. Just see it and don't say, I could have had it, but.
That was part of an interview from June 1995 with Mr. Blackwell. Mr. Blackwell passed away on October 19th, 2008. He was a fun guest to talk to. And on another note, this was probably one of the first times that I dealt with Hollywood publicist Harlan Bowle, who was like a son to Mr. Blackwell. Harlan has been one of the best in the business and also one of the nicest people you'd ever meet. I've had the pleasure and honor to work with him over the past years to book a myriad of Hollywood legends for this and previous programs. Also, a couple of weeks ago, Entertainment Weekly magazine did an excellent article in their special Oscar edition called Mr. Blackwell, the Original Red Carpet Bitch. It includes more background and some quotes from Harlan Bowle. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0288, and you'll find links to that article. You'll also find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order Mr. Blackwell's book. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In recent years, innovative ways of treating cancer have provided new hope to thousands of patients. Many of these treatments have been developed by startup biotech companies, but now a major investor in these companies is speaking out about a crisis that's threatening to derail this important research. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, venture capitalist Standish Fleming says small companies being formed to fight diseases are now, and I quote, suffering from a disease of their own, a legalized extortion by plaintiff lawyers looking to make a quick buck, end of quote. He says that small biotech companies face, on average, more than $3 million in legal and accounting costs when preparing to sell stock to fund their growth, and many can't afford this expense. Let's be fair. The last thing we need standing in the way of the next potential big medical breakthrough is America's legal system. When a leader in funding this research signals an alarm, it's time for our lawmakers to listen. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nelman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, Stuart Nelman is indeed with us with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. Well, this fall, we Canadians have a civic duty to perform very soon.
Shoveling the driveway during the first snowfall?
No, that's been done.
Okay.
We're going to be casting votes again.
Oh, yes.
Coming up.
Yes, yes, yes. Maybe, obviously, you know, although we have a fixed date now, but that could happen sooner.
Oh, maybe. That could, that could happen
in the spring, too, so you never know.
Yeah, well, a nice spring election wouldn't hurt anybody. I think that'd be nice. Weather would be appropriate for that. I thought you were going to say, you know, lining up in the parade once we cheer the Montreal Canadiens' 25th Stanley Cup victory, but maybe we shouldn't jump to conclusions right there, huh?
No, you don't want to sound like a Leaf fan.
No. But here's something: if you want to make an help you make an informed choice in the next federal election, you know, in his 15 years of public service, federal Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, he knows he wants to be elected the next Prime Minister of Canada, but not merely to follow in the footsteps of his famous father Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was Canada's 15th Prime Minister. In fact, he wants to do it. His goal is to, you know, make the country better, but by building common ground between himself and the people. And establishing this common ground is the foundation of his memoir called Common Ground. And it's basically Justin Trudeau about his aim to run, for 24 Sussex Drive this year. Now, the book is honest, down to earth, and principled, just like Justin himself. He outlines his personal quest of finding his own voice from a life of being born and raised as a prime minister's firstborn son. He realizes that there were plenty of perks and advantages of having a childhood at 24 Sussex Drive, but he credits his high-profile parents for teaching him proper values and keeping him grounded and not turning out to be a spoiled political brat. As well, he also credits his wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, for providing him with the love, support, and guidance as he pursued his professional aspirations in the political arena. What I found surprising is that Trudeau admits that he never followed the political style of his father, as would many people expect him to do so. In fact, he admitted in this book that the common touch, face-to-face, personalized style of politics that he does practice to this day, he inherited from his maternal grandfather, James Sinclair, who was a federal Liberal MP during the 40s and 50s. And his style has worked to great benefit for Trudeau, as he recalls in great detail his uphill battles to win the Papineau riding, as well as the Liberal leadership. I mean, Papineau riding was, you know, held by a Bloc Québécois MP, so that was an uphill battle. But this book, which not only tells his life story, it also acts as a platform of the policies and principles that he firmly believes in and will hopefully help him to lead the Liberals to victory in this upcoming federal election. And in fact, if you want to, you know, read a little bit more of what Justin Trudeau's all about, the appendix contains a collection of some of his speeches that he delivered over the past 8 years, including his victory speech when he won the leadership back in 2013. Now, one may think that Justin Trudeau is the second coming of the Trudeau dynasty or young political rookie, but you'll get a straightforward, clear portrait of what he is all about and what he stands for in Common Ground. In fact, with a federal election coming up, this book could possibly be some required reading for anyone who wants to be an informed voter, who wants to make an informed choice.
Which brings me to the question, is this just a memoir that comes out at a time when a federal election is on the horizon, or could this be seen as, quite frankly, liberal propaganda in time for an election?
I wouldn't say liberal propaganda, because I think it's basically a memoir that came out in time for the federal election. But you get like life story, and yes, there is a little bit of what I believe, you know, what I stand for. But it doesn't say basically vote liberal. It's basically saying, this is, you know, if I'm prime minister, here's what I believe in, here's what I'd like to do.
Okay. And the book again is?
Common Ground by Justin Trudeau. It's published by HarperCollins, and it's $32.50.
And other books in a similar vein would be?
Well, I guess we're going to have to revert back to Dad, to Pierre Elliott Trudeau. There's a couple of great books if you want to read a little bit about Justin's bloodline, about his famous dad. There's a two-volume biography called Trudeau in Our Times, published about 25 years ago by Christine McCall and Stephen Clarkson. Excellent books. And if you want a more recent take on the life of Pierre Trudeau, check out John English. John English, that's his name. He also wrote a two-volume biography of Pierre Trudeau called Citizen of the World and Just Watch Me. And that brings up to Trudeau right from the beginning up until his death in 2000.
And there are a couple of books out there, too, by Margaret, aren't there?
Yes. Well, there's the one that she wrote called Beyond Reason at the height of her, you know, how can I say, her celebrity, when she was, you know, hanging out with the Rolling Stones and what have you. And she also wrote a book a few years ago about her battle with mental illness, which is a more, how can I say, not a gossip-laden book, but a more honest, down-to-earth kind of story, actually.
So you can bookend the new Trudeau book with books about and by his parents.
Yeah, pretty well.
Excellent. And again, this week's book is?
It's called Common Ground by Justin Trudeau, published by HarperCollins, and it's only $32.50.
And how can people find you if they're looking, besides, you know, contacting CSIS?
Well, you won't see me, how can I say, stumping, you know, you won't see me, you know, campaigning for a seat in the Commons. But you can find me in the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent, sir. Thank you very much.
Now, if you excuse me, my rose and my lapel's rather wilted. I have to go get a new one.
Vote now, vote often.
Yes.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have one more item to get to, and you know what that is, folks. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
We have a twofer this time around because they are both dealing with folks too stupid to understand the reach of social media. Number one, 22-year-old Donald Harrison, wanted for assault in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, made police aware of his whereabouts when he posted a selfie on Facebook from a Greyhound bus with the notation, "It's time to leave PA." He was picked up at a stop in nearby Youngstown, Ohio. And number two, police in Houston arrested Dorian Walker Gaines, age 20, and Dillian Thompson, age 22, after they posted selfies on Facebook of themselves enjoying a handful of $100 bills, photos they took on an iPad they had stolen on January 8th, and whose photos automatically uploaded to the victim's iCloud account. Incidentally, Walker Gaines has tattooed across his chest the word brilliant. Well, brilliant he ain't. As a matter of fact, either collectively or individually, Donald, Dorian, and Dillian all received a D for duh because They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0288. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0288. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.